Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, in a world of instant digital access to all the music we could want, what should we want for the artists who produce it? We'll spend this hour with music historian Ted Gioia, who notes that while music lovers are still paying money to listen, that money often goes to subscription services like Spotify instead of musicians, who are expected to share what they make with the largest audience possible. We'll talk about the irony of artists forced to work other jobs to stay afloat while giving their music away, and about the obligation music lovers have to support those who create it. Our conversation starts after a short break. Podiatrist or an accountant or a roofer being asked to do their work for free as a wedding present for somebody. But if your thing is making music, I'm guessing you have been hit up. Friends and family know you love what you do, and maybe they assume that playing the wedding is somehow free for the giver. But is performance a gift or a commodity? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Questions about the inherent value of recorded music were less fraught before the digital era, when somebody who wanted to hear something on demand had to buy a physical copy. Since music has gone online, it seems like a gift. Most of us can listen to whatever we want, all day and all night, without ever paying the artist. How long can we go on this way before musicians can't afford to make music anymore? Ted Gioia is a musician, music historian, and author. His recent essay for Image Journal is called Gratuity: Who Gets Paid When Art Is Free? Ted, welcome back to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You started thinking about all this after you met an economist whose academic focus was on gratuitous actions. How can there be an economy to things we do out of generosity?
We tend to divide gifts from transactions in our day-to-day dealings. It's very clear to us what's a gift and what's a cash transaction. For example, when I give my wife flowers for Valentine's Day, that's clearly a gift. On the other hand, if I walk into a florist and I buy the flowers, that's clearly a transaction. But there are a group of activities in which the line gets a little bit blurry, especially artistic ones. We even talk about artists as gifted. And what I found is that the ambiguity, whether playing music, for example, or writing a poem, or taking a photograph, whether that's a gift or a transaction, creates huge problems for the artists. And the whole digital economy, I would suggest, is built on the idea that creative professionals should give away their gifts. But meanwhile, the web platforms are making billions of dollars off that. And I believe this conflict is at the root of many of the problems in our culture, and especially the problems that artists face nowadays.
One interesting problem, I think, about that word gifted is that it implies that the gifted have received something for free, right? Musicians, I mean, may indeed come into the world with special aptitude for what they do, but it takes years of work for them to rise to their full potential as artists.
When you're a musician and someone asks you to play, you know, and I talk to musicians about this all the time, what do you charge? What's a suitable hourly rate? And the complexity happens when you realize it's not just the hour of time, it's the tens of thousands of hours spent in developing the craft. And frequently musicians are asked to give that away. They're asked to give that away for exposure. To which I respond, many people die from exposure. and it's also true in the creative economy. And so this is the pressing problem. And what amplifies it right now is the strange situation of web platforms like Facebook or Twitter or Spotify or Google. They act like gift exchanges. They act as though they are nonprofit. You know, Google doesn't charge you. Facebook doesn't charge you. Facebook calls everybody a friend. And so you're lured into this idea that you should just give away. But in fact, there is a transaction there. It's just hidden from view. And that impacts all of us, not just artists. You know, we believe that Facebook is our friend. Mark Zuckerberg is the chief friend of all friends. But in fact, there are hidden charges. You know, for example, our privacy, or in the case of an artist, your very livelihood can be put at risk there. I mean, I'll point out that if you put up a song on Spotify and it gets a million streams, I mean, a million streams, just consider that. That's a huge hit. You can end up making less than a minimum wage worker for that. So there's something going wrong here in the whole digital economy and how it treats creatives. And I really believe it boils down to this increasing confusion between gifts and transactions.
Well, the folks at Spotify say we don't actually sell music. Why do you think that's not really a fair defense?
It's very funny. If you open up the Spotify annual report, they make it very clear. We don't sell music. We're not in the music business. We sell subscriptions. I'm told that if you work at Spotify and you mention that they're a music company, that you're taken to task. You're disciplined for this, because they don't view themselves as a music company, yet they are the most powerful music company. Now, this may seem to most people like a small thing. Well, who cares what they call themselves? But it's actually very huge in terms of its psychological and economic impact. Think about it for a second. Spotify is in the business of selling subscriptions, not selling music. The music is a cost of business, and all costs need to be squeezed. And in fact, if you consider it for a second, you realize the most profitable customers for Spotify are the ones that love music the least. The fans that love music the most are their least profitable ones because they're streaming all the time. Now, I want to contrast this with the whole history of the music business. For hundreds of years, everybody in the music business had a shared incentive to get people excited about music. So in the old days, you made a record, the record went from the record label to a record distributor in the warehouse. They shipped the records to the record store. The person at the record store sold it to you and me. Everybody in that value chain had an incentive for people to be excited about music. The more excited they were about music, the more money they made. Everybody was on the same page. That's not true anymore. The largest companies in music, you know, for example, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, for them, music is a cost of business. And they actually are in a strange situation where they're almost indifferent to how excited people are about music. And in many instances, they would prefer people to be less excited. This is not good. It's a terrible mismatch if you're a musician or creative professional and your whole livelihood depends on a value chain where the person at the very end of it, which reaches out to the consumer, doesn't care whether people like the product or not.
Was it really all that much better when record companies were sort of in charge of much of the process? Because they were in the music business, but they also were in the money business. They didn't care what kind of music was making money. They just wanted to highlight the artists who brought in the most.
I'll be the last person to praise record labels. There's a long history of the record label as a source of corruption, as a source of dishonest business practices. You could write a whole book on that. I imagine people have written whole books on that. But the bottom line was the people that ran those record labels realized they were in the same boat as the musician, and they needed to uplift the musician. Let me give you a great example of this. This is really the role model we should all be looking at. If you go back to the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, the most innovative technology company in the world back then was a record label. It was called RCA. And it was run by a person named David Sarnoff. Now, that's not a name that your listeners will be familiar with, but he was really the Steve Jobs of his day. He was a great innovator. He was a visionary. He ran this huge record label, and over the years, everybody recorded for RCA. George Gershwin, Duke Ellington, Elvis Presley, Toscanini, Caruso, all the greats recorded for RCA. But with this important difference, David Sarnoff and RCA saw technology as a tool to uplift the artistry of the music. Everything they did uplifted artistry. So they invented new microphones and the 45 RPM single and the best record devices. If you wanted to have a radio or a record player at your home, you bought RCA. And what they realized was that the better the music sounded, they benefited, the artists benefited, and the technology was there at the behest of the artist. The most significant example of this, and this is fascinating, RCA spent $50 million to develop television. And they owned NBC. And they decided to develop and commercialize color television, not to make money on the TV, but to get people excited about watching color television. The TV was just a one-time purchase, but if people were excited about turning on NBC on their TV channels every night, everybody would benefit. So this was a great relationship between the creative artist, the record label, and the technologies. What's happened in the last 20 years, it's been divided, and the people that have the technologies are no longer there to uplift art. They're there to exploit art.
Yeah, so you would describe a really different story over at Apple, which is in the music business, but ostensibly in the music business to sell devices.
This is the sad truth. Apple probably has more influence on our musical culture than anybody. But do they really care about music? You know, Apple would give away music for free if they could sell more devices. That's their business model. They could treat music as a loss leader. Now, what happens if you're a musician, though, and you're the loss leader? This is the question we need to ask ourselves. What happens if you're the creative professional that one of these big tech behemoths like Apple, they're going to give away what you give for free in order to sell their devices? It's not a good situation for anybody. So Apple has, and let me give you an example. This is very interesting. Up until recently, your iPhone had a headphone jack where you could plug in a headphone there. There was a little slot there and then listen to the music, and it sounded better. You had better audio quality. They got rid of it. Just suddenly, okay, we're going to get rid of that headphone jack. And people asked them, well, why did you do this? And they hemmed and hawed, but eventually they admitted, well, you know, we want to make the iPhone more waterproof. And that headphone jack was a problem in making it waterproof. So the way I describe it is Apple is more concerned about some drunk dropping their phone in the toilet than they are about the livelihood of musicians. And that may sound like an extravagant way of putting it, but it is in fact true that we're in a dangerous situation in that the company that controls music now doesn't really care about it. They don't care about the audio experience. You know, all of us had better sound systems when we were teenagers, for the most part, than we do now. When we listen to our music off these awful handheld devices, that's what happens when there's a divide between the companies that control music and the music culture. The whole experience degrades and the musical culture degrades.
When you call music the anti-commodity, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I've been very fascinated by gift giving and what we call gift economies. And the whole history of this is fascinating. These were really ignored for many years. But finally, in the 1920s, there was a sociologist named Marcel Mauss who made a very strange claim. He said that the foundation of all society is gift exchanges. You know, we all use cash every day. And if I asked you, what did we do before there was money? Most people would say, well, there was probably barter. We probably traded things back and forth. I'll give you some carrots. You give me some apples. I will give you my flowers. You give me your wheat. But in fact, what Marcel Mauss found was that in these traditional societies, they actually just give gifts back and forth, which struck people as very strange. But in fact, if you look at your own community, even right now, you know, we're all quarantined because of COVID-19, but I see all in our neighborhood, people are giving things back and forth and helping out, and that's the basis of our society. Now, here's the interesting point. In 1983, Lewis Hyde wrote a book, and he made this amazing claim. He says, the gift gets bigger when you give it away. Now, think about that. The gift gets bigger when you give it away. That makes no sense. But, it is true for things like music and what other things I call anti-commodities. It actually increases in value when you give it away. We call it going viral in the internet economy. But think about it. If I sit and practice music in a practice room, it creates no value. But if I play a song for 1,000 people, it creates enormous value. And so music is an anti-commodity. And other things that are anti-commodities are things like love, friendship, trust. They operate on karma and reciprocity, not dollars and cents. And that's what makes artistry so amazing, but also makes it so susceptible to abuse, because not everyone understands the value of something that can be given away.
My guest is musician, music historian, and author Ted Gioia, who recently wrote a piece for Image Journal called Gratuity: Who Gets Paid When Art Is Free? This is Think. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest is musician and music historian Ted Gioia, who wrote a piece recently for Image Journal called Gratuity: Who Gets Paid When Art Is Free? It seems really natural, Ted, for artists to want to share their gifts with the largest possible audiences so that their performances, as you described, have the greatest possible value. These days, that often means generating something that goes viral. But going viral doesn't necessarily mean the musician will see any material benefit. Does going viral in some ways undermine the value of the musical performance to the artist?
The artist are in a strange quandary. I think they all feel instinctively that as gifted people, they need to share their gifts. And I think this is probably the most certain way of trying to define a creative professional. It's that need to give away. And obviously I'm talking about, you know, musicians and painters and poets, but also I think people that do cooking or interior decorating, they all feel in their heart of hearts that there's a certain gift involved, and that comes with this obligation to give it away. And not only an obligation, that's how the art is transmitted. It's through sharing. It's through going viral. And so that process is inevitable. The challenge comes, though, when you've got to pay the rent, when you've got to pay the bills. And so that's where we get to this strange quandary that the musician who starts worrying about making money is accused of selling out. And you'd never accuse an accountant of selling out or the car mechanic of selling out. But when you get into these creative professions, if the artist is too worried about making money, that is a problem too. So they're forced to take a choice. And it's a very unpleasant choice. Either I give away my gift and get nothing in return, or in fact, I charge for it and get accused of selling out. And that's the real alienation or ultimate quandary of creative professionals, especially in the digital age when so many of these platforms are built on encouraging them to give away their gifts.
How is it that all of us who love music have been able to overlook the fact that we are starving the musicians who provide it to us?
The whole American economy has always been built on convenience. You know, if you ask people, do you want the best meal or fast food, you would think people would opt for the best meal. But in fact, speed and convenience drive the whole economy. And so the digital age has come out, and it's so easy to use this technology. And frankly, I'm not opposed to it. What we learned throughout history is you can't turn back the clock. There are these people called Luddites. And a quick lesson in history for your listeners, a couple hundred years ago, there were people that hated the Industrial Revolution. They thought the factories were bad for the worker, and in many instances they were, and they decided to get rid of the factories. And so the Luddites would show up with clubs and weapons, and they would destroy the factory. Sometimes they'd destroy the factory owner if he had the bad fortune to be there at the time. But the idea was that they were going to get rid of the factories and turn back the Industrial Revolution. Well, what did we learn from all that? Well, we learned it doesn't work. You can't be a Luddite. You can't turn back the clock. So I think the solution is not, when I hear musicians all the time, they tell me this amazing thing, Ted, everything would be great if we just got rid of the internet. and I listen, I think we need to go to plan B. I don't know if we're going to be able to implement that as plan A. So the reality is the internet's there. It's great. It's convenient. It offers something both to the artist and to the consumer of art. But we can't let it destroy the very artistic culture that we want to have flourishing as part of our day-to-day lives.
But is there value to giving that talent away online in building an audience that might be willing to show up somewhere and pay for a ticket and see you perform live?
The argument that's always given to the artist is that give it away here and you'll make it back elsewhere. And at first glance, that seems very persuasive. I'm told that don't expect to make any money on your record. You'll make it playing gigs. But the problem is you show up at the club and the club owner says, you know, don't expect to make any money here at the club. You should make it on the records or the merchandise. And so you have this vicious circle where the musician, the creative talent, is always told, yes, of course you have a right to make money, just not now. It's always, it's never jammed today, it's always jammed tomorrow. And the problem is that the musicians now are in this whole circle, and even the merchandise they can't make money on anymore. I just read yesterday about a startup that has this great new idea for making money. And the idea is to sell clothing that's featured in music videos. And so you're watching a music video and you see some music star wearing an outfit. You'll be able to just click right there and buy that outfit. So, I mean, literally even the t-shirts now will be going through these web platforms and intermediaries. And as each of these take a bigger and bigger bite from the apple, no pun intended, there's very little left for the creative talent. And this over the long run, demoralizes and destroys our cultural ecosystem.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Tara is calling us from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Tara.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, I just wanted to say y'all have hit a nerve with me. I have been a visual artist for over 40 years and in different fields, commercial art, murals. Now I do fine art. And invariably, people want you to just do something for them. Oh, I'm having a baby. Would you do me a baby invitation? Or, you know, I just wouldn't dream of having a sink put in and asking a plumber, hi, will you just come over and put a sink in for me? And they don't grasp that it's your livelihood and that it's a skill. And yes, there are times when I'll give it away, but I'll offer to give it away.
How do you, Tara, when you have to have these conversations with people who think, I'll just ask her to do this thing for me for free? I mean, has it cost you friendships from people who didn't understand?
I wouldn't say it has cost me friendships, but it's given me good boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, I would feel intimidated by saying no to anyone. And so now maybe I'll offer them a little discount or something. You know, mm-hmm. I'll ordinarily charge a couple of $100 for this pet portrait, but I'll give you a $50 friends and a family discount of $50 if you're interested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just something like that where they realize it's my work.
Yeah.
Not just a hobby or something I just do for the practice.
Well, thank you so much for calling. Does what Tara's saying resonate with you as well, Ted?
Well, this is the recurring dilemma the artists face. You're always asked to do things for free. And I think that we need to address this as not just an economic matter, but as a matter of etiquette and politeness and decent behavior. One of the things I've suggested over the years is that there be certain rules for when this is allowed and when it isn't. And you know, one of the key rules that I think should be followed is that creative professionals have the right to do things for free, but it has to be instigated by them. They can go and say, hey, I'd like to help this charity. I'd like to help this out. You know, people will ask me, would you do this? And I'll say, no, I will, but I'm not going to charge you because in this instance, I respect what you're doing. It should be instigated by the creative type and not by the business. And what's especially dispiriting is when the people asking you are so well paid. I mean, you look at what those executives at Spotify are making or at these various web platforms. You know, not long ago, I was asked by someone at the Library of Congress who wants me to write for free for his website on the Library of Congress website. And I said, you know, what's your salary? What are you making? You know, what's the Library of Congress's annual budget? And it's shocking when these things happen. But I think there's a rules of decent behavior. And also, I'll be honest, I believe that when these things happen, these people deserve to be publicly shamed a little bit. If you're going around asking people to work for free, because that's just not a decent way of treating people, not just artists, but anyone. And you wouldn't do it with, like I said, the plumber or the car mechanic or the accountant.
You think gifts, especially artistic gifts, should be thought about as the basis of a spiritual economy. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Well, there are things out there in the universe that we call karma, that you do good things and good things come back to you. And we tend to think these are spiritual or philosophical, but actually research has proven that there are very good economic and pragmatic reasons for all of this. This is very fascinating. If you look at game theory, there's something called the prisoner's dilemma. It's a famous game theory case study in which you've got to decide whether to cooperate with your friend or betray them.
Mm-hmm.
And what the prisoner's dilemma seems to show is that you should always betray them, that you win the prisoner's dilemma by betraying them. But interestingly enough, some researchers were doing this, and they set up this large-scale prisoner's dilemma where you played the game over and over and over again with the same people. And what they found is the game theory strategy completely reversed once you played with the same people. Betraying them, you no longer won the game by betraying them. In fact, this, and I find this fascinating, the strategy that won when you played the game over and over again was called tit-for-tat, which basically meant that if you were betrayed in the last game, you betrayed the person in the next one. And if someone cooperated with you in the last game, you cooperated with them in the next one, irregardless of who these people were. The people were changing. Now, this is fascinating because this is the same thing the gospel tells us the basis for disinterested, selfless behavior. You should do to others as you would like them to do to you. And I just find it fascinating that although we think that gift giving is irrational or crazy, and sociologists have often mocked it, in fact, this idea of doing to others as you'd like them to do to you is a good practical basis for behavior. And it also tells us that these artists who want to be able to make a living and give things away at the same time, they're not really crazy. There's a whole rational and logical basis for gift giving that we need all, should teach people. It's in our best interest for us to give.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you think it's possible, Ted, that something about the current situation has persuaded audiences who have a limited amount of time and many, many entities competing for their attention have been convinced that the gift that is being given is, in fact, their attention rather than the gift of the art that they're consuming?
It's interesting. Until very recently, my teenage son did not have a driver's license. And so I had a sort of a part-time job, which you would call teenage chauffeur. And I would drive him and his buddies around. And I used this as what you might call an anthropological field experiment. You know, here I was in the land of the teenager. I was going to learn about their attitudes towards music. So whenever I had teens in the car, I would ask them questions. I would say, where do you listen to music? Would you consider buying music? Would you ever buy an album? They would laugh at the idea mm-hmm. of buying an album. And I found that all of them said that their favorite place to go to music was YouTube, every last one of them. And I would press them. I said, wouldn't it be better, like, maybe to even pay for a streaming subscription, or let alone buy an album? And what they told me was, well, that would be stupid. Why should I pay when I can get it for free? And I have to say, these teens had a compelling argument. And so there's a whole culture that's been put in place there that when people of my generation were younger, a huge part of our allowance money and our budget went towards music. Well, that's ended. And I think once that ends, it's very difficult to bring it back. When you create a culture where people expect these things are free, how do you go back to getting them to pay for them? It's not easy.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Scott calling us now from Grapevine, Texas. Hi, Scott.
Hello there, Chris. How are you doing this morning?
Very well, thanks.
Let's see, a couple comments. By the way, a real quick one, and I recall with Sarnoff, I remember J. Philo Farnsworth inventing television and how Sarnoff just basically stole it from him and took credit. Anyway, but I've worked as an industrial designer and as a professional wildlife photographer. And the difference in the way I was treated when I was doing industrial design and creating products, I ran a wood products company for about 10 years. And so when I'd even produce a custom piece, like a nice piece of furniture for a client, The difference was night and day in that manufactured item, even though it was one piece special, than it was, for instance, me selling a mural print, size print. And the basis was that one is the piece of furniture I'd get half down and half on completion. Same thing as if I made a prototype or I made a run of products for somebody, I would get paid. If it was sold in a store, I would be selling at turnkey, 50%. Mm-hmm. Whereas with photography, for instance, or any other visual art, for instance, it's gone to a thing of like, for instance, they want you to just provide the product for free, and then they take the same turnkey and, you know, on a consignment, which is absolutely ridiculous as a business model for the artist.
Well, thank you very much for calling. It sounds very frustrating, Scott. Do you want to respond to anything there, Ted?
It's interesting if you go back when I was a student at Stanford Business School. This is many years ago. One of the first things they taught me about economics in business was that the worst place to be in business, they told me, was to be a middleman, to be an intermediary. There's low margin because you're not really adding value. You've got somebody creating something who's maybe a manufacturer or an artist or creative type, and then someone using it. But if all you're doing is just acting as an intermediary, you're not adding much value, so you shouldn't expect much profit. Now, here's the amazing thing about the digital age is the middlemen are making all the money. It's an extraordinary situation. You look at Google, they will link news sources to the end user, and they're making $135 billion a year from advertising while 2,000 newspapers go broke. So that's part of our dilemma, is how do creative types make a living when the intermediary is making all the profit?
Ted Gioia is my guest. His recent essay is Gratuity: Who Gets Paid When Art Is Free? We'll be right back. Chris Boyd speaking this hour with musician, music historian, and author Ted Gioia, who recently published a piece on Image Journal called Gratuity: Who Gets Paid When Art Is Free? Ted, I completely take your point that a lot of the responsibility for this falls on the people making huge amounts of money, the YouTubes and Spotify's and Apples and Pandora's of the world. But some of this is on us, isn't it? Music fans who, instead of paying money to patronize our favorite artists, pay for a little subscription and call it even.
There's a large issue in the music ecosystem about educating people to be wise consumers. And this is no different than any other field where whether you buy healthy food or unhealthy food or the various lifestyle choices you make. But I believe that in the situation of music and creativity, one of the problems is that we no longer see the person producing it as an actual person. Art has become so intangible, especially music, where there's no physical product. One of the great innovations in music history was turning art into a physical product when people started publishing music, the music publishers, going back to the year 1600. And for hundreds and hundreds of years, the whole success of the music business and the livelihood of the musician depended on turning that music into something you could sell, a physical object. In the last 20 years, we've moved away from it. In fact, in the last 5 years, we've reached a point where almost nobody purchases anything that's physical, and music is intangible. It feels like the air we breathe. It feels like something almost metaphysical. Now, that's tremendously convenient, but the problem is that as a disembodied force, we tend to forget that there actually are human beings making that, and it's easy to be less respectful of them or to be less concerned about their livelihood because of their very intangible nature. You know, I believe one of the things we need to do is to find ways of turning music back into a physical product, something like super vinyl, or build on this desire people have to collect. And because you'll see, actually, the creative forms where they can turn things into physical objects are the ones that still thrive. You can still sell a painting for a lot of money. It's just the intangible ones that seem to suffer. You know, my wife's a dancer, and she suffers the worst of all, because how can you turn a dance into a physical product? But that, I think, is part of the problem right there.
Do you think artists are harmed by the fact that part of the reason we're so drawn to works of art is that artists make it look easy? Like, of course, it's not easy necessarily, but for people who don't know any better, who've never tried to do it themselves, it appears as if this subset of people just have this God-given ability to produce this amazing stuff.
There are three professions, and as far as I can tell, only three professions in which work is play. And we actually use the word play when we talk about the profession. So someone who does acting plays a role, an athlete plays a sport, and a musician plays an instrument. And so I think in those three cases, you can definitely say that their work is actually play. I mean, it's an extraordinary notion to think that work could be play. But that's the whole basis of the problem, is that because their work is play, people look at it as play and almost resent them making a living on it. One of your listeners phoned in and talked about how creative types are always asked to do their work for free. And I know from experience that when someone does that and you say, well, no, I deserve to be paid for this music, they're almost indignant. The boss man is almost indignant that you're requesting payment. I think a lot of that is the idea that work is play. But in fact, the way we should look at it is the exact opposite. We should try to turn all work into play. You know, there was a philosopher named Johann Huizinga who wrote a book some years ago called Homo Ludens. He said the essence of all society is play behavior. And there's no reason why many jobs couldn't be more like playing video games, honestly. So the problem is not that work for the musician is play. It's that we devalue playfulness and we don't understand that sometimes even the people playing also need to make a living.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Luke on the line in Dallas. Hi, Luke.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to make a comment kind of piggybacking on the conversation you just mentioned. I have a friend, well, I'm getting married in January, and I had a friend that wanted to create a mural for our reception to take photographs in front of, and she's an artist, and she said, well, I'm going to give it to you, and I said, no, I'm going to pay you for it, you know, what would you normally charge, and, you know, kind of like being a subscriber to KERA, you know, as a consumer, I'm making the decision to say, I'm going to pay artists for the work that they're doing. I'm going to pay for the radio station that I'm listening to, these things that add value to my life. And I've made that determination for myself. How do we create a culture around the consumer really taking the lead and deciding to pay for the services and the gifts that they're given?
Luke, thank you for your call, and sincerely, thank you for your membership to the station, because it does matter. I don't want to take too much time away from your response, though, Ted.
We need to have institutionalized ways of conveying this message. You know, one of the things I've considered is, you know how we have New Year's resolutions? Every year you start out by saying, well, yeah, I'm going to work out, I'm going to lose weight, whatever. And generally for me, these last maybe 10 days or so before I've relapsed. But wouldn't it be great if, as a society, we had this New Year's resolution that at the beginning of each year you decide on the creative enterprises that are valuable to you and you make a gift to them? You know, so, you know, for example, at the beginning of each year, what are the magazines I should subscribe to, or the nonprofits I should donate to, or the creative enterprises there? And I think that we've got a day for everything. There's National Donut Day and National Taco Day and National Everything Day. We need something along the lines of that to encourage it. Also, I'd like to make a point that technology can help us here. You know, take, for example, blockchain technology, which is the basis of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, but it really allows amazing things to be done with computer files. And blockchain music startups are emerging right now, and they've got these great technologies in which the song actually has embedded in it both the musician's ownership and also a payment mechanism. So literally you could have an art form in which these things go viral But every time someone listens to it, you know, a tiny amount of money goes from the listener to the artist. And then we don't have to rely upon the kindness of strangers. The technology actually could do this for us. Now, the problem is, you can imagine how much traditional record labels and streaming platforms are enthused about this because it eliminates the middleman. But in fact, either we need to develop a culture where we give back to the giver or we have technologies to do it for us. But either way, we need to address this because the creative ecosystem can't flourish if it doesn't have a basis for a livelihood.
All right, back to the phones. Robert is calling us from Fort Worth. Hi, Robert.
Hello. I was calling to address the gentleman earlier who mentioned how teenagers are just buying or listening to content for free, but they don't understand they're losing the audio quality because of all of the digital compression. When we bought music at our earlier ages on LPs and CDs, we spent tons of money on the equipment to play it, even down to the phono cartridge and tone arm to enhance the sound quality, and that's what they're missing.
Thanks for calling. Ted, do young people, do they have a sense of what they're missing?
I couldn't agree more with the last caller. And I want to point out something. Music is the only aspect of the entertainment economy in which the medium has gotten worse in terms of technology over the years. I mean, think about it. When I was a kid, we had a tiny little TV set. Now I got a huge big screen TV with huge resolution. When I was younger, you went to the movie theaters and I saw these black and white movies or whatever. Now these surround sound and 3D and video games have gotten much more advanced. Every aspect of entertainment medium, the technological medium's gotten better, except for music, where people are listening to music after these handheld devices. You know, there was a day in which audiophiles, everybody had high-quality sound systems, and you aspired to having a good sound system. Teens would show off their sound system to each other. And so this is part of the problem. Once again, when the companies creating the devices that we listen to music on don't view themselves as music companies. Apple doesn't design the iPhone as a music device. The companies that make my laptop don't design it with the music in mind. They have other things and they compromise. And so we need to go back to an idea of valuing the fidelity and the sound and the whole music listening experience, because if that gets worse and worse, it's hard to imagine people getting more and more excited about the songs that they hear.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When you say that we as music fans should demand transparency of music distributors about who's getting paid and how, what are we to do with that information? How do we use it to decide which distributors to patronize, if any?
The starting point is to provide people with information because there's so little transparency right now. Even artists have very little idea of what they're getting paid per stream. And a lot of these contracts between streaming platforms and record labels are secret. I mean, they're top secret, and there's all sorts of things going on with the books there. So the starting point is to give people information, which they don't have now, but then also to create a viral respect for the web platforms out there that actually do help artists. And there are ones out there. There are streaming platforms that are owned by artists. You know, for example, there's one called Ample. It's a music platform run by artists for artists with open books, full transparency. There's another one called Resonate. It's a pay-as-you-go online music streaming and downloading service. And every artist that joins has equal rights, one vote for each member. You have Artist Share. It's a listener-funded music label. It's like GoFundMe. So they're out there. What we need to do is to give them more visibility and to get a meaningful percentage of the public involved in these fairer approaches to music. This is not an impossible goal. It could happen, and it should happen.
So it's easy in our culture to forget that the majority of working artists, people making a living from art in the United States, are like middle-class people. They're not incredibly rich and famous, and they're not necessarily starving in a garret somewhere. But I wonder, with this problem of artists not being compensated for work that they've produced, is it similar for people who are, you know, working on a sort of small middle-class scale as it is for superstars, just at a different scale? Or are people who are just trying to make a living hurting more?
Well, the music economy has gotten more stratified over time, and technology has created that. I mean, if you go back to the 1920s, 1930s, there was live music everywhere. By my estimate, there were probably 10,000 ballrooms in the United States in the 1930s where people would go dance to live music. And the live bands that were tended to be these jazz big bands. So there might be a dozen musicians working at the ballroom. Nowadays, try to find how many people in the whole major urban area where you can go hear a dozen musicians playing on a bandstand. There are almost none. So there's a certain stratification that has gone there. And what that means is a lot of musicians are wealthy. I mean, if you look at the wealthiest musicians out there, there are many of them that have $500 million in wealth. But it's not a large number. And what we need to worry about is not so much those. It's the rank and file. Because to have a healthy music ecosystem, you need to have music teachers in the schools. You need to have musicians in the community. You need to have a whole infrastructure of musicians out there. And so even in a situation where, you know, Beyonce and Justin Bieber are making plenty of money, all the more reason for us to worry about the music in our own community and how the people out there are making a living.
How and where do you buy your music?
Well, I, you know, as a music reviewer, people send it to me for free. So this is the whole gift-giving thing. But this is gets back to what I say is, and I think this is a good rule for everybody, when you get a gift, you must give a gift in return. So, you know, every day, I try to help some musician out by telling people about their music or helping out in a way in which I don't get paid for either. I try to do a lot of gratuitous action myself. And so I think this is just a good cultural attitude for all of us to have. You know, one of your listeners called a moment ago and said that they had someone create a mural for their wedding reception, didn't want to be paid. And I would say in situations like that, you give a gift back. Someone gives a gift to you, you give a gift back. That's good for our musical culture. And hey, maybe it's just good for our culture in general.
Music historian Ted Gioia's recent essay for Image Journal is called Gratuity: Who Gets Paid When Art Is Free? Ted, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me back as a guest.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can search for KERA Think wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to ours, or you can check it out on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.